third case for oral argument this morning is in the administration of the Florence Y. Wellbaum Revocable Living Trust. And for the appellants, we have Mr. Michael Bornitz, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, Dakota National Bank, we have Mr. Mitchell Peterson, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Mr. Bornitz, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court. Peterson. I am here representing remainder beneficiaries of the Florence Y. Wellbaum Revocable Living Trust. This is an appeal from a decision of the trial court. It involves fundamental principles of estate planning and trust administration. The trial court's decision must be reversed for any one of four reasons. First, the trial court allowed the trustee to sell real estate in violation of express terms of the trust when the trustee did not have informed consent for the sale. Second, the trial court disregarded the general rule that a trustee may invade principal for an income beneficiary only if specifically authorized by the trust. The third reason is because the trial court failed to apply SDCL 4382, and that statute requires the owner of a life estate to pay for maintenance and taxes on the property. And finally, the trial court refused to consider the trustee's violations of state law, its breaches of trust, and of its fiduciary duties when it came to approving the fiduciary fees and awarding attorney's fees. Turning to the first reason, the trial court's decision must be reversed because the trustee was allowed to sell real estate in violation of the express terms of Florence Wellbaum's trust when the trustee did not obtain informed consent for the sale. Now, Florence specifically directed her trustee to, quote, assure that the Inch farm is preserved in its entirety for my grandchildren. That's found in her Third Amendment to the Trust. It's in our appendix at page 120. It's very clear. The Inch farm had been in her family for generations. Trial Exhibit 21 was the sale bill, which specifically talked about that. Of course, we elicited testimony at trial about that as well. Land is a part of the fabric of Florence Wellbaum's family. This land was her legacy. She wanted to pass it on to her granddaughters. Now, as for the residence, she also directed that that be kept for her granddaughters. That's also in the trust, in the appendix at 120.
Well, aren't the trustee's powers more flexible than that, though? What about the application of Trustee's Powers Act 55-1A? The trustees have the power to dispose of trust assets. What if it... In this case, there was testimony that it was not possible to maintain all of these assets.
Well, I think in a footnote to our brief, and I can certainly point it out perhaps in my rebuttal, we indicated that the evidence was clear that there was more than enough money in this trust to pay the minimal amount of maintenance on this from Douglas Wellbaum's income. In addition, Your Honor, that would ignore the fact that Douglas Wellbaum received over $100,000 in cash outright when his mother passed away. So that's one thing. Something else that's important is that if you're going to do that, you need to obtain informed consent from the beneficiaries. In the Willers case, which we cited, this court said that a trustee has a duty to communicate, quote, all material facts, end quote, which the trustee knows or should know. That's important in this case because the trustee is a fiduciary. And a fiduciary, of course, acts primarily for the benefit of another. A fiduciary is obligated to exercise the highest degree of care that can be imposed on a caretaker of assets.
Well, what about Judge Rush's determination that there was ambiguity. I mean, in reading this, talking about a life estate in a trust as a trust beneficiary, isn't that just ambiguous just on its face?
No, I would disagree with that. I would disagree with that for a number of reasons, Your Honor. First, and I'm not sure if you're talking about in the context of his analysis of 43.82 or not, but I would point out that there is no indication that SDCL 43.82 applies only to legal life estates. And he was drawing on a distinction between a legal life estate and an equitable life estate. 43.82 talks about, quote, the owner of a life estate. It doesn't talk about the owner of a legal life estate. And in addition, as we indicated in our brief,
could it ever recognized an equitable life estate in a trust?
This court has never specifically used the term legal life, or legal or equitable life estate, but we did cite the court to a number of cases where this court indicated in other contexts that there is a distinction between an equitable life estate and a legal life estate. And of course, in this particular case, Douglas had an equitable life estate because the trust held title to the property. So that's an important distinction. And getting back to your initial question, courts generally do not distinguish between legal life estates and equitable life estates. We cited the court to Bogart, which is the preeminent authority on the law of trusts. We also cited the court to the ALR, and that ALR article said, quote, courts rarely make any distinctions in deciding cases based upon the differences between legal and equitable life estates.
All right, but 43.10.14 states the whole of the estate vests in the trustee, subject only to the beneficiary's interest in enforcing the performance of the trust. So it's a contract theory.
Well, Florence did not create a trust under Chapter 43-10. That chapter deals with real estate trusts. Florence created an inter vivos trust, and those are significantly different. So that's a distinction that has to be made here. Another important distinction in considering whether we should distinguish between equitable life estates and legal life estates is that if we interpret statutes like 43.82 to apply only to a legal life estate, that would lead to absurd results. What that would really mean is that the owner of an equitable life estate would have no obligation to make repairs on the property. The owner of an equitable life estate would have no obligation to pay taxes on the property. That holder, that owner of the equitable life estate, could commit waste, and it would be up to the remainder beneficiaries to come in and to pay the taxes and to repair the property. Something else that's important, and perhaps it shouldn't have been in one of our footnotes, but the administrative regulations of South Dakota at a number of different places talk about life estates and life tenancies. And that's at footnote 7 of our brief at page 19. I bring that up because if we're going to start distinguishing between legal life estates and equitable life estates, that's going to create significant problems. And here's a perfect example.
Well, wait a minute. Before you go there, Judge Rush indicated that it was ambiguous, that really wasn't. And Celia Minor, who drafted the document, if I remember her testimony correctly, she characterize the use of the words life estate as inappropriate or not a good choice of words, that really wasn't her intent?
Well, that's what she indicated. But What we have to do is...
But isn't that then what Judge Rush found when he found the trust to be ambiguous?
Well, I think this court gets to look at that issue de novo. You're not bound by Judge Rush's legal conclusion that this trust is ambiguous. You don't have to give any deference to that. And I would ask you to consider a number of factors in determining whether Douglas actually had a life estate. First, Florence called it a life estate in her trust. She called it a life estate a number of times. Second, that trust was drafted by an attorney. And when documents are drafted by an attorney, Your Honor, technical terms like life estate should be accepted in accordance with their legal definitions. In addition, the testimony was that Florence Minor explained the term life estate to Florence. And of course, Florence wanted Douglas to be able to live in that house. That's the essence of a life estate. And it's also important, and this is, I don't know that this is in our brief, but in Trial Exhibit 15, we pointed out to the court that the trustee itself called Douglas's interest a life estate in its tax filings. It's in the amended inheritance tax report. The trustee itself is calling this a life estate. So I think one would have to ignore all of this evidence and rules of construction to say that Douglas did not receive a life estate.
How can it be a life estate if the same document says that he's not capable of living there? It then goes outright immediately to the grandchildren. That's totally inconsistent with a life estate.
It's inconsistent with a legal life estate. I would concede that. But it's not inconsistent with an equitable life estate. What Florence gave Douglas was an equitable life estate, as I indicated, because the trust has legal title. He has an equitable life estate, and that is defined by Blacks, and I'll quote, an interest in real or personal property that lasts for the life of the holder of the estate and that is equitable as opposed to legal in its creation. This is the important part. An example is a life estate held by a trust beneficiary, end quote.
But that's it. That definition says held for the life, held for life. And that wasn't the case under this trust.
Right.
If he couldn't live there, it was going to be distributed outright to the grandchildren.
But he was allowed to live there. This was a choice that he made. And we also cited black letter law for the proposition that restraints on alienation, quote, may be imposed upon the equitable life estate of a trust beneficiary. We were citing from the law of property. That's what law professors are teaching law students in property classes. That's black letter law. What Florence created in this case was an estate on condition. What Blacks describes or defines that to be is, quote, an estate that vests, is modified, or is defeated upon the occurrence or non-occurrence of some specified event. So that's exactly what she created, Justice Center, was an estate on condition. She permissibly limited Douglas's life estate. She's the creator of this trust. She gave her property to the people that she wanted to, when she wanted to, and in the manner that she wanted to. That's her right as a settlor of the trust. The trial court improperly tried to box in what she did here in the context of a legal life estate. And that's simply not what she created. We started talking a little bit about the trustee's sale in violation of the express terms of the trust and without informed consent. That's another very important issue in this case. To obtain informed consent, a trustee has a duty to communicate all material facts which the trustee knows or should know. And we talked about the reason for that. It's a position. A fiduciary position is a position that somebody agrees to take on. In this case, First Dakota National Bank is a professional fiduciary.
All right, but didn't Judge Rush say, okay, even if they did violate, that there isn't any damage because they received full value for the property and it was transferred into the trust, so there was an exchange of assets. So what is your damage?
The damage is that my clients have been deprived of the very land that Florence specifically intended for them to have. They've been deprived of the house that Florence's father built with his own hands. That was a house, and that was land that she specifically said is to pass to my granddaughters.
Okay,
they're deprived of that legacy.
What? So you prevail on these arguments. What relief are you seeking then?
Well, this court would reverse the decision of the trial court, would find that the trustee did not obtain informed consent. We would have the option then, I think this court would probably remand for a calculation of what damages there are. Now, if you say that, yes, there was not informed consent for the sale of this land, we can't do anything about it now, we can't make the person who bought it give it back, then we can use this breach of trust and this breach of a fiduciary duty to seek the removal of First Dakota National Bank as the trustee. I should have just said that outright, but that's the redress that one of the items of redress that we would seek. In addition, of course, we're going to seek damages for the principal that was improperly invaded. And I don't want to minimize this at all, and I don't want to just say, well, there's not much for damages. It's undeniable that this was a material fact that the trustees should have been aware of, that this trustee should have told them, look, we're asking you to do something that Florence specifically said we shouldn't do in the trust. There is nothing that could possibly be more material than when a trustee is seeking consent to do something that violates the express terms of a trust instrument. And it's also material, of course, because it affects their property rights. In the Higgins case that we cited to this court recognized that a breach of trust occurs where a trustee receives consent from a beneficiary who doesn't know his rights and the material facts. And that's exactly what happened here. They obtained this consent. They just put it in front of them and said, go ahead and sign it. They never told the remainder beneficiaries that this is something that Florence did not specifically intend. They never told them this is contrary to her express wishes. So under those circumstances, that part of the trial court's decision should be reversed. The decision should also be reversed because the trial court disregarded the general rule that a trustee may invade principal for an income beneficiary only if the trust specifically authorizes it. Now, that is deceptively simple. We cited this court to black letter law. We cited Bogart. We cited the Restatement Second of Trusts. We cited CJS. We cited the Minnesota Supreme Court decision in Cosgrave, a case that was remarkably similar to the facts of this case. I think we also cited a South Carolina case. All of those authorities are directly on point and show that there is an important difference between distributing income and distributing principal to an income beneficiary.
All right. Again, what about Judge Rush's determination that the trust was ambiguous and the testimony from several people, including several people who indicated this really was her intention?
This court and the trial court are bound to look at the trust instrument first and foremost. The trust instrument says that Douglas is to have a life estate in the income and a life estate, the income from the real estate, and a life estate in the income from the investments. Florence did not give her granddaughters what was left over of the principal. She gave them the principal.
Was there an accounting as to how much of the principal you say was invaded?
Only after trial. Only at trial. No accountings were ever provided to the remainder.
Was there a damage amount that you're saying was principal invaded? I haven't seen that number.
Yes, I think it's Exhibit 47, if I remember correctly. It was about $147,000 with interest that was invaded over the years to pay for things like a roof on the house, which is something obviously that the holder of a life estate should have to pay. And that details all of those various expenses, Justice Everson, a house, a hot water heater, a furnace, all those various things.
Your turn.
See that my time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, Mr. Florence. Florence had two sons, Doug and Dan, both were adopted sons. When Florence's husband passed away, basically half of the inheritance went to Florence and half went to Dan, and nothing went to Doug. The reason for that was Doug has had marginal employment his whole life. He's worked in mission work, worked with AIDS patients. He's also very bad with money, just doesn't make the best decisions with his assets. Presumably that was the reason he got nothing from his father. However, Doug had a very close relationship with Florence. Florence assisted him throughout his entire adult life with health insurance, tickets to get home, and other support. Florence had a paramount interest in making sure that after she passed, that Doug would have a roof over his head when he comes home for Christmas or whenever he wants to live in Yankton, and they'd have a separate pile of money to help support him. In order to accomplish this purpose, Florence went to Celia Minor, her longtime attorney. They had many conversations over a period of years. Trust was drafted in 91. It was then amended three additional times between 96 and 97. While Ms. Minor might have touched on a few legal issues, the predominant subject matter of those conversations were her intentions, what she wanted to do, and how she wanted to take care of Doug. In this case, the trial court found that the trust is ambiguous regarding the use of principal to maintain the residence or other trust-owned assets. There's a four-day trial. Nearly the entire first day was occupied by testimony from Celia Minor. It's 200 and some pages of testimony that goes into all the details, the conversations that she had with Florence over the years. And based on that, the trial court found that Florence intended for Doug to have income from the trust and a place to live, and that the trust had the obligation to maintain that and provide that residence for Doug to live in. If the income were used to pay for it, Doug would be deprived of his income. That was the finding by the trial court that can be reversed only upon a finding of clear error. And notably, in both the appellant's brief and the reply brief, there isn't any single fact that's really disputed or alleged to be a clear error. It's clear what Celia Manna's testimony was, what Florence's intentions were. All of that testimony, there isn't really any dispute. So the fallback is, let's run with the trust agreement that happens to have a very inconvenient placement of the word life estate in it and try to hang our hat on that. Because if we have to get down to what Florence's actual intentions are, they can't win, because their intentions are clear. Additionally, at issue in this case is the sale of property and whether informed consent was obtained. And again, that would be a clear error review as to whether informed consent was obtained. I want to first touch on the issue of the informed consent. Mr. Bornitz described basically First Dakota National Bank as the trustee putting a document in front of the remainderman and saying, sign this. he must be referring to a transcript from a different trial, because that is not a description of how this process went. The document was placed in front of them. They were told why certain assets should be sold in exchange for different assets. In particularly, the Inch Farm was not generating income. It was in the interest of the trust to turn an illiquid, ill-performing asset into an asset that actually would generate some income. Notably, the trust principal, despite using some of it to maintain the residence, has grown by more than $100,000. It was $419,000 initially, and according to the trial court's finding of fact, at the time of trial, it was worth $525,000. That was a good decision by the trustee. The information was presented to the remainderman about why this asset sale should take place. They were encouraged to ask questions, request any information that they wanted. They chose to talk to their father, Dan, who is a well-respected and successful businessman in the Yankton area. After conferring with their father, they signed the consent. The trial court found there was no reliance by the remainderman upon anything Celia Minor or the trustee told them. They made their decision based on talking with their father. That is a specific finding of fact as to why they made the decision that they made.
Does it make a difference that the consent was for sale at $94,000 and the actual sale was $80,000?
It does not, because the fact that the consent initially was for $94,000, the property was sold for $80,000, was actually, I believe, $4,000 more than the appraised value. That information was disclosed to the remaindermen over a decade ago. They made no objection until recently. And again, even if the consent is somehow suspect because of that, greater than fair market value was actually obtained. It was nearly 10% more than fair market value.
Well, who set the price then? Was this an auction, or did how was this price determined that ultimately it sold for?
I believe it was sold through a realtor. If the record differs, I certainly would defer to the record on that. The Inch Farm, I know that was an auction process. I think the residence was handled in a more traditional setting with the realtor. The remainderman, Mr. Bornett, cite to the restatement of trust, in particular, I believe it's Section 233 that says you can't invade principal for an income beneficiary, and you've got it. Basically, the principal has to stay there. Notably, the comments of the restatement talk about when a trust asset is sold and substituted with another trust asset, that even if there is a lack of informed consent on the sale, that the trustee is still credited with the value of the incoming assets. In this case, it's undisputed that the new assets acquired are worth more than the old assets, particularly the Inch Farm and the old residence, which was turning into a money pit from a maintenance standpoint. I want to make sure we spend some time on what I think is the core issue in this case, the use of principal to maintain the residence, ambiguity, and the settler's intent. I want to touch for a moment on something Mr. Bornitz argued. He said it's black-letter law that courts generally don't distinguish between legal life estates and equitable life estates. Justice Zinter then asked Mr. Bornitz, well, isn't distribution while Doug is still alive and incapacitated, distribution to the granddaughters while he's still alive, isn't that inconsistent with a life estate? Mr. Bornitz's response was, yes, it's inconsistent with a legal life estate, but it's not inconsistent with an equitable life estate. So the remainderman seemed to distinguish between the two when it's convenient and seemed not to distinguish when it's convenient for the argument. The key thing to look at is not whether it's legal life estate or equitable life estate. Those labels are, I think, somewhat meaningless. What should be examined is it actually a life estate within the context described by SDCL 43-8-1 and 43-8-2? And SDCL 43-8-1 defines a life estate as ownership with the same rights as a fee simple owner would have, except you can't do anything to prejudice the inheritors. The fee simple rights and a life estate owner rights, those would include things such as managing the property, renting it, selling it, assigning rights, subletting. These are all things that the trust specifically says Doug cannot do. Doug doesn't have a life estate. The trust owns the property. Doug has a right under the trust to live there when he wants to live there. And under trust statutes, in particular 43-10-14, Doug doesn't own anything. Doug, at most, has a right to enforce the terms of the trust. The reliance upon 43.8.2 is the point of that argument by the remainderman is that Doug ought to be paying to maintain it since he has a life estate. Again, that presumes that a life estate was granted to him in the first place. The trust itself doesn't grant it, and when Celia Minor's testimony is examined, it's clear that there is no intention on the part of Florence to grant a life estate in the same sense as the remaindermen are using that terminology. In fact, the trial court found that given Doug's history of spendthrift habits, being bad with money, really never helping with maintenance around the house when he was home, that it would be inconceivable that Florence would entrust the maintenance of this house to Doug. She loved him. She wanted him to have a place to live. She wanted him to have some income to live off of, but she was realistic. She knew that Doug was not capable of maintaining this property. That's why that responsibility was placed upon the trustee.
When Judge Rush made his finding, was it the language about life estate that he primarily found made this ambiguous? I'm trying to get a concept of what that means within the context of a trust. And the terminology equitable life estate, which we've never recognized, how do we deal with that?
Well, I think if this Article 3, 4B, that has life estate in three different parts. If Celia Minor had used some other term that doesn't have so much loaded into it in other parts of the law, I don't think there'd be any ambiguity. It'd be clear the trust has to maintain the property. If she had used life interest, right to live there for life, used some other terminology other than sort of the easy terminology of life estate, the trust wouldn't be ambiguous. It would be clear. We wouldn't even have to get into the conversations that Florence had with Celia. The fact that she used a word that appears in some statutes, and those statutes have some meaning that the remainder of them want to hang their hat on, that's where this problem comes in. The word life estate is used twice in the same article. In particular, Doug is granted a life estate in income generated from a Nebraska farm, a life estate in income from the Inch farm, and then a life estate in other income generated by the trust. There is no such thing as a life estate in income. It's a real property right. So clearly, Ms. Minor wasn't using the term life estate in the same sense as it's used in the statute cited by the remainderman. And it's also clear that Florence didn't intend that as well. Again, it's a terminology, as Celia Minor stated. It could have been worded better and more clearly. It wasn't, but it's still clear enough. And then when the background context is considered, the family context and all the conversations, it's clear that Florence would not want Doug to have the responsibility of maintaining this home. That is a responsibility that falls upon the trustee. It's a responsibility that benefits the remainderman. If Doug was responsible for doing that, it'd be anyone's guess whether that asset would actually have any value by the time it passes to the remainderman. The trustee has invaded principle. There's no doubt about that. But the principal has never been paid to an income beneficiary. The principals have been used by the trust to maintain an asset owned by the trust. That is not an abandonment of duty, but that's the exercise of the duty on the part of the trustee to make sure the property is maintained, that it's insured, that it has heat on so the pipes don't freeze up. Those are the kind of things that one cannot entrust to Doug, particularly not knowing how often or how frequently he would live in the home. Now, as it turns out, following Florence's death, Doug has lived there nearly permanently, but his history had been living in Australia, Europe, New Mexico. Given that history, how could Florence expect a world traveler who was home for a few days at Christmas to really be responsible for maintaining the home, for paying the taxes, for purchasing property and casualty insurance? I mean, he didn't even get his own health insurance half the time Florence had to pay for that. Given that history, the intention is clear. Doug was not capable of maintaining it, therefore that responsibility was placed upon the trustee. If there are no further questions, I think that concludes the argument.
Do you agree with Mr. Barnett that maybe this estate was what's called an estate on condition? Have you thought about that?
I don't believe Doug actually has real property rights. He has rights under the trust. I mean, that's not in dispute. Whether that is a real estate right or an estate, I honestly don't know the answer to that, because those are phrases that really have not been adopted by this court. An equitable life estate, as far as the estate on condition, even if the court were to find that Doug had a real property right and an estate on condition, that isn't a life estate. And the only way to get to 43.82 that requires Doug to make the payments is if the court gets to a life estate as defined in that same chapter. And 43.8-1 says you need fee simple rights, which Doug doesn't have. The remainder man concede he doesn't have that. That would be the requirement before 43.82 kicks in, is that the actual definition is met. And it's not. Just because the same word is used doesn't mean that the rights conferred are the same. The rights just don't match one another.
One of the objections was failure to obtain court approval. Would the Trustees Powers Act of South Dakota apply in this case, 55-1A, which specifically says that you don't have to get court approval for sale by a trustee?
Your Honor, I admittedly have not read that particular section. I think that's escaped the analysis so far. Certainly, if the law says that, then it makes this issue moot. If the court does determine that court approval needs to be obtained, I think I have two responses on that. Number one would be the trial court in this case basically gave it a de facto approval, finding that it was not a breach of fiduciary duty. It was in the interest of the trust to get an asset that performed better, in fact, has performed better. And my second response would be that no harm, no foul. More than fair market value was obtained. All of the proceeds were put into the trust. They've continued to grow. So there really isn't a remedy when you've got consent and lack of damage.
Are you still done?
I am done, Your Honor.
We ran out of questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bormitz, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Justice Zinter, I'd like to begin by addressing your question to Mr. Peterson about the difference between a legal and equitable life estate. This is something that we need to figure out. This court has to determine whether it's going to recognize legal and equitable life estates. It's estimated that the state of South Dakota holds one half of the nation's trust assets. People from around the country and people who write trusts, people who create trusts, are going to be looking to this court's decision in this case to determine, in essence, whether or not, when I write something in my trust instrument, it's going to be followed by the trustee. That's what this gets down to. We cited a number of authorities that talked about the difference between a legal life estate and an equitable life estate. Let me give you one example. I think the state of South Dakota would care a little bit about the distinction. Because if we're not going to make a distinction, then somebody could, in a trust instrument, give 10,000 acres of farm ground, give an equitable life estate, not legal, give it in a trust, give an equitable life estate to 10,000 acres of farm ground, and the assets that that farm ground generates could not be considered for Medicaid eligibility purposes. So we do need to figure this out. We need to make sure that we understand these distinctions. These aren't distinctions that we're just making up. We cited the law.
Is this a legislative matter, then, if it's of statewide importance, or do we deal with it?
No, it's not a legislative matter. This court has recognized on a number of occasions equitable interests. We cited those on page 4 of our reply brief. In Reichert, the court in that case recognized that the trustee held legal title to the land and that the beneficiaries retained an equitable interest. That's what we're talking about here. In Shotwell's trusteeship, the court recognized, quote, an equitable right of ownership. And we cited other cases as well. So that's something that's critically important. Florence created an estate on condition. As I indicated, she gave her property to her son Douglas when she wanted to and in the manner that she wanted to. And this case, first and foremost, is about a trustee's obligation to follow what the settlor said in the trust.
All right, I want to go back to 43-10-14, and you said that doesn't apply because that's a real estate trust. But this is a trust that holds real estate. I don't know what you mean by real estate trust.
Yes.
That states the trust vests the whole of the estate in the trust, in the trustees, subject only to the execution of the trust, and the beneficiaries take no estate or interest in the property, but may enforce the performance of the trust. Why doesn't that apply?
If you look at Chapter 43-10, that is a statute that authorizes the creation of a real estate trust. That's the only thing that can go in that type of a trust is real estate. Florence created an inter vivos trust. Her trust was not one that was created under statute. So there's an important distinction there. And we talk about that on page 5 of our reply brief, Justice Severson. You know, as I step back, it's important to consider something else. Florence drafted this trust in 1991, and she amended this trust 3 separate times. Not one of those times did she ever talk about giving her son, Douglas, the right to use principal. She certainly knew about Douglas's propensities, that he probably wouldn't pick up around the house, that he probably wouldn't take care of it. She knew that when she drafted the trust. She knew it when she amended it the first time, the second time, and the third time. She chose not to allow the trustee to use principal on his behalf. She also chose not to relieve him.
On the use of principal to the income beneficiary, the only claim you're making is the property or the money that was used to maintain the house, correct? You're not saying there was any other transfer to the income beneficiary?
That's correct.
Okay. just to clarify where you're coming from.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So Florence chose in the trust and in the three amendments never to allow Douglas to use principal. And it's quite clear from reading the trust that she knew what principal was and she knew what interest was. She gave herself the right to use principal in her trust instrument. She never gave her son Douglas the right to use principal. She gave her trustee the discretion to use principal for her own care, for her own support, and for her own maintenance. But she never gave that power to her son Douglas, the person that she created, the person that he was, the person who wasn't going to take care of the house. She knew all this. The difference between using principal and income is important. Do we not think that somebody would have talked to Florence? Well, do you think, knowing what you know about Doug, that he should have, that the trustee should have the discretion to use principal to take care of the house, because he's not going to do it? Do you think that the trustee should have discretion to care for Doug, to provide for his support, because he's been a jet setter and you've had to provide for his health insurance from time to time and you've given him a gas card?
Okay, but that wasn't done in this case.
That's the point.
Oh,
she knew all that, and she didn't provide for the use of principal for any of those purposes, Justice Severson. We have to look at what this trust says. Douglas gets the income from the real estate. He gets the income from the other investments. That's all he gets. Every time Florence talks about the use of income, she also talks about the fact that the remainder, the principal, goes to my granddaughters. Every single time.
Well, it does say if the trust fails, it goes to Douglas.
That indicates that if the trust, for example, has a de minimis amount of assets, yes, that it can be distributed outright to Douglas. But of course, nobody agreed here that giving Douglas $500,000 in trust assets at the time that this occurred is something that Florence intended. So, you know, I understand the point that you're making, Your Honor, but that's a rather boilerplate provision. There's no specific reference to Douglas. There's no specific reference to the granddaughters. It's a rather boilerplate provision that appears in almost all trust instruments.
One thing to clarify before you run out of time. Your argument about invasion or use of principle, you know, that's really conditioned, though, on us finding equitable life estate, isn't it? Because there's no dispute the trustee would have power to maintain trust property. You're saying that's wrong in this case because essentially this wasn't trust property. It was an equitable life estate. Is that a summary of your argument?
I would say this. Now, I've been taught not to re-summarize. I would say this. Our issue with the use of principal on behalf of Douglas is that he is called an income beneficiary time after time after time in this trust. And the general rule, Justice Center, is that trustee...
Then you want him to be an income beneficiary, not to hold an equitable life estate.
He's an income beneficiary because he gets the income from the real estate. He's an income beneficiary because he gets the income from the assets in which the cash was invested, but he holds an equitable life estate in the residence. That's what we're saying.
So isn't it inconsistent to say that you have some real estate interest and at the same time you're only an income beneficiary?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, he holds an equitable life estate in that property. He gets to live there for as long as he chooses. And he gets to live there under the terms and conditions that his mother set forth. I don't know if the court has any other questions. I see my time has expired.
It has.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bornitz. The court will be in recess.